It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strangechamps. Here in the 21st century, there are a lot of old crafts we don't have much use for anymore. Blacksmithing, wood turning, spinning, basket making. But funny thing, as our world gets more and more virtual, traditional skills are starting to look better and better to a lot of people.
My family and I, we do fur trade reenactments.
Meet Sarah Dauman.
We live in a tent on certain weekends with a whole bunch of other people who live in tents, and everybody dresses like it's 1790. All the women are like, I just sewed this new corset. What do you think? Like, it's just very... And the guys are all like, let's go black powder hunting. And at first, when we first started doing it, even my good friends were like, huh, that's a lifestyle choice. It was very, like, Now half of them are like, we have a tent too, and can we join in, and can we come to it? And so that right there, even in that niche, there's interest, real authentic interest in learning those old ways. Everybody's sharing trades. You'll spend 3 hours with the flint napper, and then you go and someone's making a box with nothing but hand tools and teaching. And someone's weaving with reeds and teaching and talking about it. And so you're learning all these old things, and your kids are learning it, and you're with everyone who's excited about it. You do have moments. You do rendezvous, and then you're yelling, do not run with a tomahawk, to your kids. Or, no, you cannot hunt the geese in the park with the spears you just made. But it's so much fun, and everybody around you is just loving it so much.
For Sarah Dauman, old world handcrafts are not just a weekend activity. Sarah is a full-time professional coppersmith, one of, if not the, only woman in the country practicing the trade. She makes pots and pans, simple, basic, timeless cookware using copper, iron, and tin. She drills and rivets, hand tins, buffs, and polishes each piece using antique tools.
Half of these tools are originals from the 17, 1800s.
Can I touch?
Yeah, of course. Nothing sacred. I mean, don't break it. I can't replace it. I'm kidding. All of these rotary hand tools are from the early to mid 1800s. They are original, and I use them to build everything I build.
What do they do?
This one, they do what they're called. So this is called a setting down machine. Uh-huh. It sets down seams. This is a burring machine. It burrs. See, they were really original back in the 1800s. This is a turning machine. It turns the metal. And that happens a lot. See, it keeps breaking off.
Standing in Sarah's workshop, it strikes me that while I pay attention to where the ingredients I cook with come from, I know next to nothing about the pots and pans I use. And that suddenly seems kind of odd.
Yeah. We have spent so much time talking about the food itself, but we don't talk about where the chemical change happens and what it's made out of and who made it and where the materials come from. That was the crux of the very first conversations I started having when I started building an American cookware line, partially because everywhere I turned, the reaction, even from the foundry owners and the metal spinners that I was talking to, was supportive but skeptical. Why are you doing this? You're going to be competing in price range against items made in China, and why would you invest in this? And I'm like, well, because someday it'll matter. Someday people really, really, really are going to care about where it comes from, or they won't have access to something in China. I wasn't trying to have a premonition, but more and more, I'm like, maybe I should stop talking because it comes true. But I wanted to be able to be very transparent and say, well, the mines are in this country, the mint is in Canada, and then this gets shipped to Iowa, and then they make it there.
So it's those big sheets of copper?
Yes. So this here is kind of, this is a standard piece. So if you want to pick that up.
Oh, wow. That's heavier than I thought.
Yeah. Ready?
Whoa. Oh, wow. Yeah. So when you start, you know, you're going to make a pot, let's say. How do you start? What's the first?
The first step is to create my pattern, which is a lot of painful math. Then I just start cutting my sheet metal with my stomp shears, which is another tool from the 1800s, that big piece over there, and it's like a giant scissors. It will chop off your fingers.
So you got into this through the history, because you're a historical novelist,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
So how did writing historical novels lead you to discovering and teaching yourself the lost art of coppersmithing?
It was not planned. I do like to research excessively before I start even writing my novels. And so just because then I feel like I don't have to cross-check my facts, it's osmosis. It almost feels like if I close my eyes and think too hard, I could fall sideways into the past. And I have very lucid dreams where I wake up and I have to like spend a day or two reminding myself that that actually didn't happen because it's so visceral. I'm in the kitchen. I know where everything is in these kitchens. This was the cookware they used. This is how it got fixed. This is who would fix it. This is, you know, all of those things. And I realized, well, no one's really doing that anymore. We should do that again. Over time, without meaning at all to become a full-time coppersmith, that's what happened.
Will you show me a little of like something you would do?
Yeah, we can build something. We can just do some small cone here. Or if you want to, you're welcome to. First and foremost, if you were going to make a cup or a little pot or something like that, you'd have a piece. Again, you'd cut it on the big stomp shears there. But you would run it through the rollers right behind you.
Okay. So now we're putting it in the roller, which is a little bit like a pasta machine.
It is. And you always are adjusting every step of the way. Round and around and around you go.
What's your favorite metal?
Copper.
How come?
Because it's very beautiful. When it's shiny and new, it ages well, and you can do so much with it. You can make bronze and have weapons if you live in 1300 BC. Like you can pour it if you melt it enough. It allows you to be a little bit more creative because it's so movable.
So something like?
Yeah, a little fish poacher, yeah.
Okay, so what is this?
It's a fish poacher. It was hand-built.
And then lined with tin.
Lined with tin.
Why is copper lined with tin? I guess I never really knew.
It's because copper is a reactive metal. When you're cooking with it, at a certain temperature, you can actually, the way the copper interacts with your food and the proteins in your food, you can get sick.
Oh, from you can poison your... Yes,
you can,
great.
You can get sick. So tin is inert, so it doesn't react with food. And it's actually kind of nature's Teflon. It's nonstick.
I didn't know that tin was nonstick.
Most people don't. And that's why the beauty of tin-lined copper, what I love about it, is it'll never go in a landfill. It's always repairable. Whereas all of the other cookware out there eventually fails and has to go in a landfill. So I love the renewability of using the plain, simple, basic metals. Copper's so soft. Now we get to hammer. But I do get people sometimes who come to me because they get a copper skillet and they use it like a cast iron skillet. And then their tin melts on them. And they
it
go-
It can actually melt?
It can because it melts at 450 degrees.
Oh, wow.
And that gets reached really fast. And I get people coming to me and they go, it melted. And I'm like, so you overheated it? No, I don't think we did. I'm like, okay, it's a science fact that tin can only melt at 450 degrees. It didn't melt at 200 or 375. If it melted, you overheated it. No, we were very careful. If you've discovered magic tin, we should tell the world.
It doesn't seem like it's necessarily that hard, but I think of coppersmithing as... Don't you need a lot of physical strength?
Yeah. Yeah. This part is kind of the delicate stuff. When I'm tinning over a fire, you need to be able to hold pots anywhere that are, you know, a pound to 20 pounds over your head, stable, while it's got molten metal in it, and then you wipe the metal out. So I'm very strong. I've had people who want to come and work for me, and after a day or two, I actually have sent them away, and I've said, go lift weights.
So you're
in the shop.
You're not strong enough to do this.
It really just becomes like, I'm like, okay, hammer these things, and they can do like one. We have 40 to do. Keep going. Your hands have to be really like strong, and then your muscles, your upper body has to be really strong to handle it. I have my own weight room in my house, and I lift weights 5 days a week, and then I run another 3 days. It's an incredibly grueling job. Almost every time I'm in the shop, I get hurt. Whether,
how? I mean, what?
A lot of times I ruin my hands. Mm. Or you put your hand in a pot and you get a huge burn because the pot is 600 degrees and
you
forgot to wear long sleeves, so you get a giant burn. Or your neck gets burned from the fire, or you burn your hair off.
Have you done all these things?
Yes.
What keeps you coming back to this?
I like the physicality of it, yeah. I think. And I like the knowledge that I'm keeping something alive that would otherwise be dead, because I learned this trade by apprenticing myself to a metalsmith, to Bob Bartlemy in West Bend. And I've been doing that since 2015. Mm-hmm. I don't get paid for that. That's years and years. So who wants to put in time for free to learn a trade? Now, to me, I learned something that no one can ever take away from me. There's incredible value in that. I'm eyeballing. Here we go. We're gonna use the stump shears.
Okay.
Just don't put your fingers in. It's a giant scissors.
I'm a giant scissors, but you just cut a sheet of metal in
my hand. No, this is a skinny one. So I'm going to. All right. I like the physical building once I've done the math. I like building something. Whether that's a mug or a bowl or a cup or a, you know, sugar pan. To me, they're really fun. And I really like tinning. Seeing the finished beautiful pieces filled with like moonlight, because that's what it looks like. It's just shiny silver. It's just so cool. And there's an art to it too. Like it's a feel.
How do you actually do it? You literally melt tin?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that burner behind you right there.
Yeah.
That becomes a 600 degree fire. I have to wear full body gear, a carbon canister gas mask because the fumes are very poisonous. I wear a welding glove on one hand and nothing on the hand that actually touches the tin. Mm. because I like being able to feel what I'm doing, and I don't know. I like the idea of being strong. I like the, for lack of a better word, the feminist kind of vibe of that, because I'm stronger than my husband. He's taller than me, he's bigger than me, but I'm stronger than him. I want my kids to grow up saying, oh, healthy is strong, healthy is powerful, not healthy is skinny.
Good for you. These are so beautiful. Look at these. How old are these?
1700s.
Wow. Moment of truth. Way too big.
How is that possible? See, this is why you do this.
You want more hammering?
I remember talking with a friend who was an artist a long time ago who said, the more machine, the more hand, meaning the more we create technologies to fill our lives with products, the more people actually wind up craving handmade, hand-built.
Yes, that's a really beautiful way of saying it. And I do think more and more people are turning inward and going, what would happen if the infrastructure that I assume is there is now gone? Can I exist? Having working knowledge of a couple of trades, you feel more secure. Like if I had to take my family and go live in a cave, I'm not worried. you know.
Yeah, I mean, you must feel like, hell, yeah, we could head out there and build our log cabin, and I'd make a living as a coppersmith.
Yeah, I know. And I look at my husband, and I go, what would you do?
What's the difference between a hobby and a trade?
A trade is something that you learn, and then whether or not you use it as a business or as a hobby is totally up to you. So even though you might be only a weekend blacksmith, the fact that you know how to do that means you still have a trade. No one can take it away from you. It's buried in your sinew and your bones, and it's just part of that hand knowledge. There's power in that that translates, again, to just self-confidence. So many people talk about, you know, that's something lacking in young kids who just aren't doing that anymore, not playing outside anymore. They don't have confidence anymore. So that is what is so exciting about seeing more and more people pick up these traits. Hopefully that's going to translate to happier people, and then the world would be a happier place. Like, you know, Putin would probably be happier if he knew how to be a blacksmith.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I was wondering if you thought there was kind of an uptick of interest in trades and handcrafts because of the pandemic. I mean, I started having fantasies of maybe I should take a building arts program because I don't want to be dependent on somebody else to build my house. Could I build a house?
Right?
Which seems kind of ridiculous at my age, but then part of me thinks, I don't know, why not?
Well, and that question right there, if you ask yourself, why not, the next thing you should think is, well, I guess I should just do it then. Because if you don't have a real answer for why not, then the answer should just be, well, yes, I guess I'm going to. Why not? Why not do it? And good things always happen.
Sarah Dahman is one of the only female coppersmiths in the country. She founded her cookware line, House Copper, in 2015. She's written about the craft in fiction. Check out her novel, Tinsmith, 1865, about a woman smith. Or read about Sarah's personal journey and the history of cookware in her new book, Copper, Iron, and Clay. Coming up, how far would you go to meet a living legend?
So I chartered a flight to a lake, two lakes north of there, Talaquina Lake, maybe 40 miles north of where Dick lives. And then hiked from Talaquina Lake down to Turquoise Lake and crossed a river, and then hiked down to Twin Lakes and crossed the Chilicadrotna River, and then hiked along the shore to meet Dick. Dick was bigger than life, and I just wanted to meet him that way, and just spent one night with him, sitting with Dick at his cabin and listened to his stories.
Dick Prenicke spent 30 years living alone in the Alaskan wilderness in a cabin he built himself. Life doesn't get much more handcrafted than that. More after this. On to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio, NPRX.